welcome to another edition of Expanding Mind. I'm your host, Eric Davis, and we'll continue our explorations of the cultures of consciousness. One of the funny things about studying religion or being fascinated with religion is that you kind of see traces of it everywhere. Now, that doesn't mean it's necessarily there. It's like if you're a student of poetry, you can read through scientific journals and you might, you know, pick out the way they use metaphors to explain things. And that might be pretty illuminating, but it doesn't mean that the meaning of the scientific document is essentially poetic. And similarly, you look at religion, if you're interested in religion, you look outside in our supposedly secular world, and you find a lot of traces of it, but I think there's still a pretty good case to be made that human beings have not escaped the anthropological and religious matrix that we come from. And this was not the way it was supposed to be. You know, 50 years ago, everyone was saying that with modern development and technology and global media and spread of education and capitalism, that we were basically going to move into a secular post-religious society, which most certainly has not happened. And not just because Islam is such a polarizing and dynamic phantasm in our global imagination and a real force, of course, as well, in its various complex zones, but also that the sort of things that look secular to us on the surface may actually be more religious at root than it first appears. I mean, one obvious example are all the singularity guys, you know, these people who are, you know, technologists, engineers, futurists, who are, you know, drawing out the curves of development in all these various technologies and pointing to some asymptote moment of total historical transformation where we're sort of thrust into some AI, robotic, science fictional universe that we can't by nature even be able to comprehend. And so this singularity is lying ahead on the historical timeline, and it's coming up quick depending on who you talk to. And, you know, these people are almost entirely secular, technological, rational, scientific in their rhetoric. And yet, for a student of religion, this is very obviously a repetition of a certain kind of religious way of understanding history and transformation and mystical powers and all sorts of things. And so even if there is a scientific argument to be made for it, there's also clearly a cultural pattern that's deeply religious. And we see that all over the place, not just in scientific rhetoric or the way people think about technology as some kind of transcendent force, but also very much in politics. And that's a lot of what we'll be talking about today with our guest, Simon Critchley, is how these religious questions don't go away, particularly when you boil it down to some of the core questions of what is politics? What does it mean to have faith in a political system? What does it mean to have to organize a society along certain ideas of law or power or authority? And that when you boil it down, these ideas and assumptions often have a profoundly religious character, not just that they come from religion, but that in themselves they speak to the same needs, desires, and fantasies and hopes that go along with religion in all of its varied forms. So I really look forward to having this conversation with Simon Critchley, who is a professor of English at the New School in New York City, and he's written tons of books, and he's one of those rare, all too rare, of thinkers who are professional scholars, but also are very readable and very interested in communicating with people outside of the narrow, jargon-laden corridors of academic politics. And one sign of that is he edits and writes frequently for The Stone, which is a really cool New York Times blog on philosophical issues, and he also works with me on editing on the Philip K. Dick exegesis project, where he gracefully submitted some fascinating annotations of Dick's Gnostic material, and so maybe we'll get to some of that. But before we bring Simon onto the program, going to introduce, of course, our co-host here, Maja Dawu. Hey, Maja, how are you doing?
I'm good, Eric. How are you?
Pretty good. Hey, what's when you think about things that a lot of people think of as being secular, but are actually really deeply mythic or religious, what comes to mind?
I mean, I can't separate any structure from those things.
You can't even think that way before.
They're so intertwined invariably, like throughout history. I mean, you look at Moses' laws, you look at Hammurabi, like the first place we get writing and communication. It's all language is that way, politics is that way, eating, you know, it's everything. You can't eradicate it because it's all tied in with these kind of like codes. I think it kind of breaks down the codes, like what's the role, because secularism, they're like all, everyone's trying to establish these codes, whether it's laws of government, you know, health, whatever, you name it. And then, like, so how do you separate that from the mystical kind of quality? I think you can't, because, like, you know, it's just in the math, in the language, it's in everything. So, it's tricky.
One of the things that Simon talked about, and we'll bring him on in a second in his most recent book, Faith of the Faithless, he talks about the idea that to organize a whole society based on laws and that, like, lawfully following, you know, rules, and that it's a rule-based system itself comes out of a deist way of looking at the world, where it's
yeah.
idea where God sets up all the laws and then he kind of you know, takes off and goes into his own realm, and the thing kind of runs itself. And so if you use your reason, you can figure it out how to set up a system that's going to work along those lines. So there's no escaping the shadow of the God.
There is not.
Yeah, so with that, we'll bring on Simon Critchley. Simon, thanks so much for being on Expanding Minds.
Hi, Eric. Hi, Marcia.
Hi.
So I thought one place we might start is just to kind of locate us a little bit in this question. You know, again, as I mentioned, there was once an idea that kind of religion was on its way out, and yet religion is so present in our political discourse, not so much just in the obvious sense of wrestling with Islamic fundamentalism or even Christian fundamentalism, but really that the engagement with politics now on among philosophers as well as, you know, people in the trenches has this sort of this religious dimension that maybe would seem surprising from the outside, and I'd love to hear you kind of place us in that religious return.
There was a story, I suppose, that, you know, people, particularly people in Western Europe when I grew up, told themselves about life after the Second World War and the institutions of the welfare state, and we'd achieved a certain secular society which was tolerant, liberal, open, and which seemed to be a kind of historical achievement, right? We'd finally achieved a period of peace after centuries and centuries of European countries slaughtering each other for various bits of land. So there was that story that was told, and I suppose what's happened in the last 30-odd years has been the picking apart of that. That's one side of it, and then at the same time, to realize that story we were telling ourselves about social democracy as the end of history was a kind of religious narrative as well. And so I think that religion is sort of omnipresent, but in quite concrete ways. I mean, in the US, I think it's particularly the case because, you know, you were talking about deism, and it's very interesting. I mean, you know, there is there's the Constitution, which is the framework within which law is conducted and the rights of citizens are enacted in this country. It's underwritten by an appeal to God, right? The very beginning of the Constitution is through an appeal to God and God's trust. It's even there on the dollar bill as well. But that God is a God who is somehow present, but cannot intervene or override the operation of law. So there's a, if you like to use the term political theology, there's a political theology in the US of a very particular kind, namely some belief in a transcendent deity, and yet it's still the case that an atheist cannot be elected president of the United States. It, you know, hasn't really happened. It's still a good way off. So you have to believe in some idea of God, but then the question comes down to whether God can intervene or override law. And if you read, I mean, if you want an example of this, I mean, a really powerful and contemporary example, then it's Barack Obama's The Audacity of Hope, where he lays out his belief in the Constitution and the supremacy of law in all matters, and in the next chapter talks about his belief in God. But it's a God that cannot intervene or cannot intercede in the domain of law, and that's deism. If you're a Christian, you believe that there was a moment, at least one moment, when God became incarnate in human form, and that God, Christ, intervened pretty dramatically in the operation of human law, namely the law of the Roman Empire or the law of occupied Palestine, as it was then, and made an appeal to a different order. So, to make this all very concrete, you know, there was a whole debate, you remember, in 2008 around the so-called race issue, the way it was played out here, between Pastor Jeremiah Wright and Obama. And the Wright were trying to use Jeremiah Wright, to show that, you know, Obama was a dangerous kind of terrorist figure or whatever. Now, if you listen to Jeremiah Wright's sermons, he is proclaiming a kind of prophetic Christianity, right? And a prophetic Christianity that believes that God interceded into the world and can intercede again in the world, and that God overrides law and can throw over the tables of the money changers and bring about a kind of revolution, right? And Barack Obama distanced himself very quickly from that view, yeah, in order to make sure that, for him, there is a God, sure, but that God does not override the Constitution. So, in many ways, a lot of debates in American politics simply turn upon, matters of theological interpretation. But there is, if you like, regardless of people's personal belief in, whatever. Well, it's a good joke, as it were. But I remember somebody saying, you can be in the U.S. You can be a Muslim, a Jew, a Catholic, or a Buddhist, as long as you're a Protestant Jew, a Protestant Catholic, and a Protestant Buddhist. Namely, insofar as you accept the separation of private belief from the public life of the state, and so you can believe in one God, three gods, 20 gods, or whatever. But you have to sign up to, as it were, the civic religion of the United States, right? And so what you have in the U.S. is a very robust form of civic or political religion, which is very interesting, and it exerts a considerable power over people.
Let me ask you one question about Obama that I think is sort of interesting, especially because it's been in the news. Mm-hmm. Lately, I mean, anybody who's interested in civil liberties issues and anyone who's concerned about the excesses of the war on terror will see that even though there is that strong rhetorical and in many ways procedural affirmation of law in the doings of the administration, there are also these places that people are getting increasingly concerned about where something like that law or the balance of powers or procedure gets interrupted, and this is what is called, among people interested in political theology, this sort of state of exception. Yeah. When is it that the law that rules the land can be abrogated because somebody gets to say, well, yes, but in this case, the president has the right to essentially sign the death warrant of an American citizen living abroad without mm-hmm. process. So.
Yeah, it's a great question.
People talk about that politically, but give me the kind of religious slant on this very, very important problem.
Yeah, I mean, we have to go back to Rome, and Rome is Rome was always the model for modern republics. Greece became the model in the 19th century, but it was always Rome. So the American legal system was, and you see that in the, you know, the institute, the architecture of Washington D.C., which is a kind of evocation of a Roman style of architecture. Okay, for the Romans, there was rule by law, by what was decreed by the Senate within the, you know, their understanding of the juridical process. But in a time of danger, and there was also a kind of civic religion in Rome, based around all sorts of rituals and habits and all the rest. Anyway, but in a time of danger, the law could be suspended. They would declare what's called in Latin a justitium, a kind of suspension of law, and the Senate would elect a dictator. And the dictator would be able to make decisions that were not framed by law in order to guarantee the security of the Republic. Now, and those dictators usually were in power for 6-9 months, and then the Senate resumed authority. Now, you fast forward to 2001, after 9/11. What begins to happen then is the in relation to what is seen as the danger to the homeland caused by 9/11. Effectively, there's a kind of suspension of the law, and all sorts of measures are taken in order to protect the homeland. And the president, George W. Bush, and more particularly Cheney, assume quasi-dictatorial powers, right, in order to make certain decisions which they think are in the benefit of the homeland. So, you know, and a lot of what Obama was about in 2008 was that if you like, the Republican administration from 2000 to 2008 was a kind of threat to American democracy and a threat to the sort of legality of American democracy, and we had to return to rule by law. But what's happened, of course, is another kind of slippage. So there is rule by law and all the rest, and yet there are drone strikes and there are targeted assassinations. So, you know, what happens now is not the as it were, suspension of a legal order in order to invade a foreign country with a military force, but you know, people in trailers in Las Vegas are, you know, operating drones in order to bring about certain ends. That's a kind of,
well, and it's very much. I mean, speaking of Rome, it's a lot like the Pope. You know, like they'll be the God's laws that are set forth. And then the Pope gets to say, like, oh, well, it's cool if we do this, because, you know, and the Pope does have that dictatorly ability because he has, yes, that infallibility. So, like, it's almost like Obama is very much acting in the same manner, where there are these set laws where, like, you know, you can't invade people's privacy, you can't just murder people, you can't just do that, that's the law. But then there'll be these people who are in those positions that get to be above that. They're usually appointed for those purposes, to go, mm-hmm, above the law, you know, and then, like, say, well, it's okay to murder these people because it's, you know, better for everyone, or God told me, or, you know, whatever. But it's like the same kind of thing for me.
Yeah, we realize that, in a sense, we're not really through with monarchy, in the sense in which,
yeah,
if you look at the classical function of the monarch in, say, in Tudor England or in 16th, 17th century France, the monarch was a physical being, was a king with a name, you know, and but also had his authority derived from God. There was a divine authority. And you see that still on the House of Windsor, the heraldic symbol of the House of Windsor, the House of Arms, the coat of arms, sorry. It's, you know, Dieu et mon droit, God and my right. So that law, droit, is ensured through an appeal to God. And that appeal is what the monarch, that's the function of the monarch. So the monarch, in a sense, is a physical being like us and a quasi-divine being. Now, we believe that the revolutions of the 17th century in England and then the revolution of the late 18th century in the US were about not the monarch being God, but in a sense the people becoming God, in a sense of not monarchical sovereignty, but an idea of popular sovereignty. But the office of things like the president still shows that we still we still kind of want a monarch with quasi, you know, divine powers. It's very odd. You know, we don't seem to want democracy, which would be us actually making the decisions. We have to appeal to some higher authority. We want some kind of presidential figure, and that's theological, I think.
Yeah, I mean that gets me to another one of the really interesting contrasts in your book that I'd like to unpack a little bit is that on the one hand, part of the fear of real democracy is because there is this. Again, a political theological idea out there that basically human beings are sinful and broken, and that if you left to their own devices, they're going to cause havoc, and so somebody else needs to organize the system. So even if we have democracy, you really want to know that Big Daddy, who's going to keep things under control, because left to their own devices will go crazy, and that authoritarian urge is even among people who think of themselves as being democratic, embracing liberalism, embracing these kinds of principles. And so you make a really good case for how those ideas are still going on in they're very strong elements in authoritarian views of how to deal with all of the chaos, social, political, economic of our moment. And yet you also want to introduce a different way of thinking about it that we can think of simply as a more anarchistic approach, really looking to historical anarchism as a way of modeling very different kind of social relations with very different kinds of underlying sort of feelings and religious patterns, ones that are not about original sin, but rather a kind of even a kind of mysticism of love that comes in with this that you go into a good deal of detail on. So I'm just kind of inviting you to just sort of, you know, you can compare or contrast, or really just sort of talk about this less discussed way of bringing religion and political inspiration together in a kind of anarchism with a politics of love at the heart of it.
Okay, there's a lot going on there. Which let me see if I miss anything, just bring me back to it, because it's But I mean the first thing, just to stay with the American situation, is to go back to the debates around the Constitution, and you know, it's very clear in someone like Madison that he wanted to construct a system. So the problem was, I mean, if you like, the political problem was that how how could people who identified as Virginian and British, or Massachusetts and British, and that apparently was the pattern of identification with land owning white folks in the 18th century, how can that be broken down and an American identity can be invented? There was that problem, and then the problem was also, well, how can we have something like democracy that looks like democracy without actually what Madison calls the inconveniences of democracy? And the inconveniences of democracy were, for someone like him, the threats of mob rule, the threats of, you know, the rule of the rabble. So it was the institutions of the US were designed with very, very large constituencies, with a relatively small number of representatives, which would ensure that people were sufficiently far away from the center of power. So, if you like, the number of people in the House of in Congress and in Senate, with regard to if you measure that against the population of the U.S., the number of representatives is much lower than in, say, other representative democracies like Netherlands, UK, France, which is an oddity, right? If this is such a democracy, why are there so few representatives? There's that question. Then to go on to the other set of issues, I mean, we think we want democracy, but I'm not sure we actually do, because there is this deep fear of each other and fear of what might happen when when authority is actually removed, you know. So I mean one thing, you know, to sort of lead up to the second half of what you were saying, I mean, when during the OWS protests and the other Occupy protests across the US a couple of years ago, one of the chants that was made was, this is what democracy looks like. This is what democracy looks like. And that was a very kind of accurate empirical remark, because what OWS and other groups were trying to practice was direct democracy, right? And direct democracy where everyone would be involved in the formation of law or statutes or recommendations that would be then followed by the group. It's a very time-consuming and exhausting process.
Yeah.
What we have is a representative democracy, where we give the power over to representatives who we believe represent us. And the kind of magic trick of democracy, which nobody really thinks about, is that somehow we believe that each of us has a vote, or if we're lucky, if we're allowed to register for a vote, and that vote represents our will at some level, given the limited number of choices that we have, and those wills can be aggregated together into a certain number. A representative is elected, and those representatives, if they form a majority, can form a government, right? And then those representatives somehow incarnate the will of the people, right? So there is this kind of completely mystical appeal to the American people, or or the will of the people, or what the American people want. And you find, particularly on the right, but not just on the right at all, you know, politicians will begin sentences with, "I think what the American people want is," right? And that's a kind of appeal to a complete fantasy of what the American people is or might be. And democracy is somehow that kind of magic where we imagine that our will is somehow transubstantiated into government and into the being of the president, and there's a kind of identity there. The point I'm trying to make is that the actual political system we have is really very odd and completely saturated with all sorts of religious assumptions that we don't tend to think about very much. So,
right. And that, which seems to open up the possibility for rethinking things, not just on the basis of, you know, what the best form of representational democracy would be, but what's going on beneath that? What are these sort of, you know, whatever religious algorithms or programs or assumptions or axioms that people are running? Like, what are they actually really believing that allows these constructs to emerge? And maybe there's different possibilities there. There's different options for...
There's a kind of cynicism. I think, you know, every political, certainly the two major parties, but I've got no reason to believe other parties wouldn't be the same, organize themselves around the question of belief, you know? I mean, it basically the same. Romney was using that one word, believe in America, maybe it was believe in America, last year, and in 2008, that was the core of Obama's campaign, believe, right? So the appeal is an appeal to something like religious belief. And I remember that night in the Mile High Stadium in Denver, I think it was, where you just saw when Obama was talking at the end of the Democratic National Convention, and there was a kind of it was church, and people desperately wanted to believe. I mean, that has to be at the very least analyzed, unpacked, and thought about. I mean, because it's kind of weird. And it's not. It's not particularly democratic, you know. It's a kind of fantasy of a savior, right?
Yeah.
That we're going to be saved by someone who is that person that we want to believe that person is. So I think a lot of people, Obama says this in O Dusty of Hope, you know, they believed in the Obama that they saw, and they believed it so much that they believed he was going to work in their interests, and then people became disappointed. But yeah, it's that kind of fantasy of belief that's incredibly powerful, which is, as Marja said, it's kind of papal or messianic, you know?
So we should take a break right here, and when we come back, I definitely want to get into the spiritual anarchism and some of the
So
we're going to take a break here. You're listening to Expanding Mind with Eric Davis and Marja Daru. We're talking with the philosopher Simon Critchley. We'll be right back. Thank you.
Expanding Mind on the Progressive Radio Network. This is Maja Daou here with my co-host Eric Davis, and we're having a discussion with Simon Critchley about deism and God and politics and law and all of those things that we all know and love so well. And before the break, you had mentioned a little bit about it, you know, having that messianic quality and that thing of having someone save you. And it's, to me, I mean, I think about all the things you were saying you can see not just on government levels, but we see them anthropologically in all structures from families on up, right?
Mm-hmm.
That they're within the family, it's the same thing. Like everyone looks to the father or the parent to kind of seek someone to give them that infallible law that will, you know, tell them what to do, and then they'll, like, rescue them if they need it. And I wonder, you know, what do you think about our tendency to present these, to actually make laws for the purpose of absolving responsibility from ourselves?
Yeah.
And
placing
that responsibility in someone else. I mean, what do you think about that on an individual level?
I think it's a quite tricky question. There was a fantastic film last year by Paul Thomas Anderson, The Master, and
that film raises
a question, which is a question, because the two figures, like a Philip Seymour Hoffman character and Joaquin Phoenix, as they. It's a long film, but at the end of that film, basically the Joaquin Phoenix character, who's this kind of, you know, renegade, drunk, but charismatic, strange figure, leaves the master. And the master, Philip Seymour Hoffman, says to him something like, if you believe that there can be life without a master, then I'd like to hear about it. Or if you believe there can be life without a master, then come back. And then the last scene of the film is a bedroom scene with Joaquin Phoenix and an English woman that was working in a pub in a bar in England, and he ends up, the last words you hear are the very words that the master said to him. He now says to her.
He becomes the master.
So there's a very deep question about whether we can live without a master. And when you're talking, you know, when Eric was talking at the beginning about the singularity discourse, you know, and Kurzweil, that, you know, there's a kind of master there, or in a lot of, we can point at the Pope or church leaderships as forms of mastery, but I think exactly the same thing happens in relationship to a lot of forms of, say, New Age spirituality. People want a master who will instruct them, and they want to be taught. Well, I was watching the other night a really I'm doing some work on suicide notes, which is another conversation for another time, but it's a sort of grisly, strange area. But I was looking at the Jonestown massacre from 1978, a documentary on that, and reading about it, and Jim Jones is a kind of master figure, right? Who was a master who, as masters tend to do, it was all about equality, and in Jim Jones's case, racial equality, he interpreted the Bible as expressing a form of socialism. Very interesting. But there was a kind of delusion of the master which he was subject to. Now, the question I think that we have to ask ourselves anthropologically is whether we can live without masters. And I'm not sure whether we can. Democracy as a form of politics is very demanding, because it would be to live without masters. We actually become masters of our house, or mistresses of our house. And you know, the signs are that's a pretty hard thing to sustain. Yeah.
Well, and I talk about that concept a lot because I'm very fascinated by it. And it's like we have set up all these laws and codes kind of to prevent ourselves from thinking that we can do that. It'd be like, look at the army for an example, right? It's all hierarchy. It's all structure. So, like, what would happen if you had an army of generals instead of, like, one leader and everyone else just kind of following along? There, it would be, like, the strongest, raddest army ever. So what I don't understand is, like, why can't people, like, kind of, what if we had a country of presidents instead of, or, like, a country of kings instead of these hierarchy systems? Like, what kind of, what would happen then, you know? Like, we would either all just kill each other, it would be, like, the raddest situation ever, you know?
Well, it could, well, I mean, it's been, I think there have been, you know, in the, in the U.S., particularly in the 19th century, you've got a whole series of experiments around this, this question. You know, you've got secular groups like the Owenites and the New Harmony Project, and then you've got groups, religious groups that really interest me, like the Shakers, who were trying to organize themselves on the basis of gender equality, and were practicing a kind of radical interpretation of the gospel, and, you know, leading a kind of some kind of theocratic but democratic form of life. These experiments, you know, appear here, and they're sometimes short-lived and die out, or the ones that don't die out end up as kind of authoritarian structures, such as, say, Mormonism, which is, you know, which was also, you know, developed in the in those decades of the 19th century, but went on to develop a very hierarchical idea of the priesthood and the church, and has done spectacularly well. So there is a question here about whether, sort of losing my voice, whether you can whether we can actually sustain democracy, whether we can actually practice it. And I think it's much harder than we imagine it is. You know, that's my basic point.
Right, and then part of this, the challenge is in some ways spiritual, in the sense of what can we imagine about our possible relations? How can we be in relationship to other people? The unknown that is in other people. And that's where it seems really interesting, because, you know, I could be listening to this conversation up to this point and say, well, clearly what we really need to do is to get all of the religion out of politics, because it's still screwing it up, and that way we can get to this sort of, you know, better place. And it's like, well, no, maybe what really needs to happen is to come down and develop new models or recover older ones, or reformat older ones that have different possibilities in them on that level of affect or heart or spirit or whatever kind of word you want to use for it. And that to me was the most surprising and refreshing thing about Faith of the Faithless, which is a really great book
It's an affirmation of religion. I mean, it's, you know, for me, religion, as other people have pointed out, it goes back to the old Latin term religare, which means to bring together or bind together, like a kind of ligature, so for me, the core, it's like the positive core of religion is always the idea of association or community. That's its, that's what it's able to do, you know, in the form of a church or in the form of a community. So, the question that I think, you know, in many ways, the history of religion is a history, certainly in relation to Christianity, but it's not so different in other traditions, actually. It's always a conflict between forms of religion which become institutionalized and authoritarian, and then forms of religion which protest against that. So Protestantism is really protest against the institutional hierarchies of the Catholic Church. And then once Luther had taken that, you know, whatever the right metaphor would be, cork out of the bottle, then, you know, a thousand different flowers bloomed, which led to the kind of religious, different religious enthusiasms of the early modern period in Europe, and then in places like the US, where, in a sense, once the structures of authority have gone, you don't have to obey popes and priests. You can, in a sense, become your own priesthood, right? And you can become your own you can become your own authority. And that's why, you know, a lot of the Protestant churches don't have those kind of authority figures like the Quakers. And I think it's a constant battle in religion between forms of, if you like, authoritarian religion and forms of anti-authoritarian or, if you like, anarchistic religion. For me, anarchism is a poorly understood word, because people think of anarchism as people dressing in, you know, black ski masks and smashing windows in McDonald's or whatever. Whereas anarchism is, it's another thinking of human organization, social organization, which is not based on the state and capital. It's based on the idea that if we are liberated from the bonds of the state and the financial relations which usually exist between us as customers or clients or whatever, or as workers, then we can find another set of social relations. I think some of what you've been saying before appeals to that, but in a sense, what a tradition like anarchism is about a different way of understanding social relations. And, you know, there's a way of understanding social relations which is that basically human beings are nasty, brutish, and mean to each other, and we need law in order to prevent us killing each other, and that's why we need the police and the rest. The other way is to say, well, actually, it's because of the state, the police, and the law that human beings act in this way, and if we were freed from those structures, people would act peacefully with each other. And that comes down to another kind of belief, right? Whether you believe that human beings left to their own devices would cooperate pretty peacefully, or whether they are nasty, violent creatures. And there are two strong traditions that would make those arguments. My view is that we're, you know, in the right circumstances, human beings can get along in remarkable ways. But, you know,
Where does that belief come from you? Is it something that you kind of came to in a sort of philosophical way after going through a lot of different ways of seeing the world and flirting with nihilism and understanding arguments and then kind of going, you know, I'm going to pitch my tent here, or I'm going to pitch in with this possibility?
I come out of a tradition of ethical socialism in Britain, which is what was very powerful and really was the kind of motor behind organizations like the Labour Party and the trade union movement. And it was an idea that, I mean, you know, if you, for example, there's a great book I read a couple of years ago on the intellectual life of the English working classes, right? Written by a New Yorker. Fascinating book. And he just documents what working class people read in the 19th century in England. And people that were radical, saw themselves as radical. And they weren't reading Marx and Engels. They were reading the most, guess what the most widely read book in the 19th century was amongst working class English people?
No idea.
It was Bunyan's Pilgrim's Progress.
Uh-huh.
Mm.
Pilgrim's Progress. That was the book, because that spoke to a certain condition of temptation, of despond, but also the possibility of redemption. But it was a kind of moral narrative, right? And so for me, there's kind of political traditions I've always identified have come out of a deep sense of, you know, moral commitment. I've always had a deep-seated moral belief that human beings are fundamentally decent. They're fundamentally decent, and extraneous circumstances can force them into situations of conflict. I remember being involved in an occupation at the new school about 5 years ago, and this was with a lot of undergraduate students, but also a lot of people that weren't students, and they occupied a building, and there were two people from the faculty there who were just sort of hanging out in solidarity with them, and we were watching them trying to have a conversation, right? they're trying to have a meeting. And it proved to be enormously difficult because very quickly people started to shout at each other, right? And they shout at each other the way they shout at each other on television, right? Because in a sense, that's what people thought a conversation was. It's a kind of, you know, screaming at each other in that way. And I watched, David Graeber, who's now become really famous and synonymous with Occupy Wall Street and all the rest. But David was there, and David was trying to show with a couple of other people how to have a conversation, right? Where you listen to other people, and they listen to you, and then you come to a view, right? And eventually they got it. Eventually they got it, and they were able to talk to each other. Now, why can't people talk to each other? It's not because they're bad. It's because we inhabit spaces where forms of kind of superficial conflict are what are expected of us.
Yeah.
When we're in cars and we, you know, or when we judge people on the basis of, you know, skin color or accent or whatever it might be. I mean, you know, it's those we exist and we're forced to exist in those kind of sets of relations. And I think that's the work of why we call ideology, right? There's a deeper, I think there's a deep decency and sympathy that people have with each other, and people, ordinary people, are only moved to violence, I think, in situations of real desperation. And those situations
well,
are largely understandable.
It's complicated. I think that's true for the majority, certainly. And I mean, the reason, the impetus for laws to arise in the first place is, you know, the majority of people are like, yeah, that's totally close to what we do. But then there'll be the rogue element, the trickster, the variable, right, the statistic
yeah.
anomaly, where most people would only do that kind of stuff out of desperation. I agree. However, there's another contingency, and I don't know. I do not have the answer, but I don't know that it's just like humans are decent or humans are evil. I think you can't
yeah.
separate it moralistically into those categories. Is a great white shark evil because it'll eat something, or is an orca evil because it'll play with the sea lion instead of just eating it? Like, animals do things maliciously, not just for survival as well. And then
mm-hmm.
so there's those humans that will do malicious acts for survival, but then there's this whole other thing that exists, and I feel like that might be what inspires these kind of, you know, deistic laws, is because we don't know how to deal with those anomalies, where most people will be, like you said, they'll figure it out, they'll sort it out, but then there's these chaotic elements that are impossible to sort in those legal kind of ways, because these
mm-hmm.
people just don't care what the consequences are, you know?
There are sadists out there, you know, as I think the story, the Cleveland story,
sure.
you know, made very clear a couple of weeks back. I think the kind of sort of sick fascination with that was, you know, with that. I mean, how can somebody do that to other people? You know, how? And there are, yeah, sure, there are going to be, you know, nasty people that do nasty things, but it's a question of what you do with that. And actually, the law is.
Right.
Usually quite powerless in relationship to that. You know, the law, certainly the law in this country seems to be spectacularly powerless when it comes to dealing with sadists and the people that really should have help, who have access to semi-automatic weapons or whatever. You know, it's, you know, I wish, to that extent, I wish there were a more robust law in many ways. It would be. Yeah. So yeah, I take the point, but you know, I think about situations like what's happening in Syria at the moment, where you had a peaceful, non-violent opposition to a repressive, authoritarian regime of President Assad, and because of the violence that was inflicted upon that opposition, they became violent in their turn, and now we have a civil war. Right.
Right.
The meaning that the first instinct of people in political organizations is often how can we find a voice peacefully, organized, non-violently, and then there might come a point where one is pushed so far that the move to violence becomes necessary. You know, and in the U.S., that was the question that was posed in the late 60s. You know, I was doing an independent study this. this semester with an African-American student here. We're reading this book by James Cone, Black Theology and Black Power, which is an extraordinary book to look at now because it's about, it was written directly after the assassination of Martin Luther King, and it ends up with an argument for violence, right? And you can see how in certain circumstances, a coherent nonviolent movement, say for example the civil rights movement in the 60s, reaches a point where the violence inflicted upon it is such that one has to push back in a different way. And I don't condemn those moments. I think they have to be understood. But they're usually not what the activists want, first of all. People usually find themselves in a situation where...
Well, and that's what's weird. Like, it almost grows out of control. Like, take, for example, there's the few sadists that are weird, right? But those can catch on, and all of a sudden you can have an entire country enslaving another race. Or all of a sudden you have Germany and Nazis. So it'll be like a sadist that then spread to a large political level on the level of a country, right? You have a nonviolent movement that's peaceful.
Yep.
And it's trying to, like, accumulate this steam, and then all of a sudden it'll get, like, overtaken by, like, the counteraction. So you can almost see it, like, go in these waves, but it's like there's some kind of contagious element in it. But, I mean, do you feel like that violence has to come in because it just reaches that certain point? Or, like, why is it that it has to, like, it's... just has to come in there sooner or later?
I think I put it a slightly different way. It would be that, for example, if we think about... the United States of America. A few years ago was the 400th anniversary of the Jamestown settlement, right? And the narratives connected with that, whatever. 1607. By 1618 or 1620, the first ships were sailing up the James River with slaves. To organize for plantation, the first forms of plantation slavery. It took my compatriots about 12 years to work out this was the way in which this place could be exploited, occupied and exploited. And then plantation slavery becomes the norm all across the South and all the rest. Now, for me, it's a question, it really is a question of what history we tell ourselves as about who we are and where we're from. And I think that we all come from a history of violence, right? And that history of violence is deep, and we do our best to repress it. So, you know, the very same people, as other people have pointed out endlessly, the very same people that are there in the Declaration of Independence and the Constitution are also people that were operating plantation slavery and all the rest. That the operation of law can somehow close our eyes to the history of violence that we come from. So I think, for me, the first thing that has to be woken up to is that violence and our capacity... Yes, so I seem to be saying contradictory things, but I hope they're not, in the sense which we have an extraordinary capacity to dehumanize each other, right?
Mm.
And the ways in which dehumanization happened in the modern period was around questions of what was called race and all the rest. So
just letting you know here, we're going to have to wind it up. I know you're
okay.
Mid-zone, so...
Okay.
Darn it.
No,
oh,
I know.
There you go.
It always sneaks up on us. But Simon, thanks so much for being with us on Expanding Mind.
Thanks, Eric. Thanks, Majid.
All right. From me and Majid, all you out there, keep your minds open.